happy to have her here today. So I'll let her take it over. Take it over, Katie. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Dr. Lucena and Fong. I'm going to share my screen really quick. Share. All right, can everyone see a PowerPoint presentation?
Yes.
Okay, yes. Perfect. All right, so welcome. Today, this workshop is titled Creation and Collection, How to Design and Select Instructional Media for Your Classroom. So we're going to be talking about various design elements you can use for creating about and evaluating your own instructional media, as well as techniques for finding instructional media that is has high utility, that's a little bit easier to access compared to traditional copyright materials. Specifically, we'll be talking about open educational resources. So first of all, it's great to have you all here. My name is Katie, as Dr. Lucena mentioned. I received both my bachelor's and my master's from FSU. For my master's degree, I studied instructional systems and learning technologies, which is a very broad field, but in short, we essentially analyze problems in learning and performance, and then we apply various techniques that are either instructional or non-instructional to solve some of the problems in learning and performance. And a big part of my field is online course design, various types of online learning, and sometimes designing instructional media. In the past, I've worked as a psychology tutor as well as a TA, and I was the PI graduate assistant during the spring 2020 semester. And finally, I was an instructional design intern, which is where I got a lot of experience working with designing online course materials and online Canvas shells, things like that. So today's agenda consists of five parts. First, we're going to describe a few elements of good media design. Can anyone hear me? I think we had some feedback coming from someone's screen. Okay, cool. I think we're good now. So these elements will essentially help you to both evaluate your own instructional media that you might be creating, as well as, you know, conduct some quality assessment techniques and employ those skills when you're looking at other instructional media so that you know you're getting something that has been well designed for your learners. We're going to identify a few common design issues that we might see with various types of instructional media, which will help give you an idea of what to look out for. We'll list some helpful tools for instructional media design. Many of these you either have access to for free as an employee at FSU, or they are free or have free versions that are highly usable online. We're going to then explore the utility of open educational resources, and then we'll discuss strategies and resources for using OER in your classroom. So first off, I want to start with a self-reflection question as kind of a pretest. Take a moment and think about what is your current level of comfort with designing instructional media or just visual media in general, things like, you know, posters, worksheets, anything like that. And you can type your answer in the chat. And this will just give us an idea of where we currently stand in terms of design comfort. Check the chat here. Okay, I'm seeing a lot of low to moderate. Yeah, and that is about what I expect because, again, this can be a very specific field. It's not something that necessarily every single industry talks about very often. And today, the workshop is essentially going to serve to just give you some basic general skills that you can apply, nothing too advanced. There are resources in case you are interested in furthering your knowledge into more advanced levels of media design. But overall, we're just going to go over some of those basic, highly applicable principles. So next slide. So now I want to ask all of you, what is wrong with this picture? Take a minute and look at this. This is a waste hierarchy diagram that I believe it's showing various types of waste disposal techniques. You can see all of the source information off on the side of the slide. Just take a few minutes and tell me some of the problems you see with this particular piece of media. Yep, too busy, cluttered, definitely overcomplicated. Mm-hmm. To be honest, I think someone pointed out, is this a flow chart? I'm not even sure if it's a flow chart because of the way it has been designed in such a cluttered, busy, difficult to navigate design. Contrast issues for color, too much information. Yes, so all of you picked out really, really key components and problems with this particular piece of visual media. And the reason that I show this to all of you is because I think that many people do have this sort of instinctual idea of what should and should not be in a piece of visual media or, pictures, diagrams, worksheets, things like that. Even if you don't know all of the exact terminology we use in design fields for identifying principles and elements of visual design, you do have an idea of, when something doesn't look quite right in a particular design. So go on to the next slide. This is where we get into some of the actual core elements, the first one being alignment. Now, alignment is something that can have a couple of different meanings in the field of instructional design. Usually we use it to talk about the learning objectives being closely linked to the activities and assessments within a particular course. But when it comes to visual design, alignment simply means, are the elements on that piece of media aligned with each other? So you can see in the image here, in the first example, everything is in a nice, neat line. It's visually pleasing. It's easy to follow in a linear fashion. Whereas the lower example is out of alignment. Everything is kind of crooked. Nothing quite lines up with anything else. This can cause some confusion regarding, what pieces of information go with what images. It can be distracting simply because, it's a little bit crooked on the page. So this is your first element that you really want to make sure you follow closely when you are creating a piece of digital media so that, you don't have anything that's sort of confusing or out of alignment with other pieces on the page. The next piece is the contiguity principle, also known as proximity. Now this has to do with making sure that elements on your instructional media that go together are in close proximity with each other. So in the left-hand side of the image on the slide, you'll see that we have the text. So t-shirt, shoes, scarf, trousers are closely linked to the pictures with which they correspond. Whereas the image on the right side, you have all of the little icons clustered in one corner, whereas the words are clustered in another corner. Now, of course, all of us can tell which words go with which pictures, but let's say you were teaching some sort of advanced zoology class. Your students may not necessarily know what some of the terminology means, and therefore, if the terms are far away from the pictures or your diagrams, that can cause some confusion as the proximity is not showing your students exactly what goes together. So that's why this is important to keep in mind, especially when you're combining pictures with text that specifically go with those pictures. Repetition is our next principle. This is a small example listed on the right side of the screen. I believe this is some sort of booklet or slideshow. And this is the idea that throughout your design, if you have multiple pages or multiple screens, that there is some element of consistency, because it can be a little bit jarring if you have one screen or page that uses one color scheme or one set of design pattern, and then the next few screens are totally different. So again, this is just the idea of keeping everything nice and consistent so that you have a good fluid transition throughout your instructional media. Finally, we have contrast. This is something that many of you pointed out. The diagram before lacked this principle very severely. And this is simply the idea that the various elements you have on the screen stand out and they are distinct. So in this particular picture, we have on the left side a very light background with dark font on top. On the right side, a dark background with light on top. And this ensures that everything is nice and readable. You don't have your text blending into the background you've chosen for your instructional media. It can also have to do with when you have a lot of text on a piece of instructional media and you have certain keywords or certain headings that you want to really stand out. Bolding those or making the font a little bigger or a little smaller, depending on what you're going for, can help bring in that element of contrast and bring those really important highlights to the surface within your worksheet or your infographic or whatever you may be designing. Now on this slide, we get into color, and I've left it blank for a moment because the images are a little bit jarring. The first two are from an office.com article, which is linked below, talking about combining colors in PowerPoint. And it goes over some of the common mistakes that designers make and how to avoid those. The third one is an openly licensed resource. So I'm gonna make those appear now. Here's the first one, second one, third one. So when you look at these images, what comes to mind? What feels like is wrong with these particular color combinations? Kurt, exactly. You got it exactly right. So the problem with specifically the first two pictures where you have blue background with red font and red background with green font is that this tends to cause eye strain in viewers. So when you're looking at it, even from where I'm seeing and I created this slide, I'm kind of squinting looking at it because it's hurting my eyes because of the eye strain. So this is an example of a color combination that really does not work very well with designing instructional media, and particularly with combining background and font color. The third option, I think someone pointed out in the chat, has very low contrast. So the background color, even though this color combination doesn't necessarily cause eye strain, it's a little bit hard to read the text on top of the background screen because they are so similar in nature. So a few rules of thumb for utilizing color in your instructional media design. You want to match warm colors with warm colors and cool colors with cool colors. Now, if you don't know the difference, that is totally fine. You can simply Google a color wheel if you're working on something and you want to be reminded of what constitutes warm colors and what constitutes cool colors. If you prefer a physical object too, you can find these at many different types of craft stores. And again, it's the issue with eye strain often comes in when you combine those really stark, cool colors with the really bright, warm, warm colors. Additionally, one thing with red and green that you have to be careful with is that can cause an accessibility issue with individuals who have various forms of color blindness. They may not be able to read various things on your instructional media. So that's a color combination in general to avoid. Additionally, less is more when you're figuring out a color scheme for your instructional media. This article that I've linked below, the 50 Most Important Rules of Document Design, sort of uses that as a general number to stick to, four or fewer, because if you, as we've seen with the diagram I showed earlier on in the PowerPoint, if you choose too many colors, then that can be a little bit overwhelming for your viewer. Depending on the theme of your lesson, you might choose dark tones or light tones. And by the theme, I mean, are you teaching something that's a lot more serious, such as how to be professional in a research poster presentation? That's something that we often learned in research methods. And the way instructors tend to teach that is to use a much more sleek, professional looking instructional media design for their PowerPoints or any other pieces of media they're using because that fits with the theme of the lesson. Contrastingly, you might have something that's a bit more fun and lighthearted, or you want to make it really colorful and fun, and then you might go with a light color scheme. It all depends on what your particular theme is for that lesson. Additionally, it's good to consider the emotion that is associated with various colors. So if you put a lot of different fonts in red, that can tend to make people think that, you know, that answer is wrong or that terminology is wrong, because often, you know, we see red associated with stop or with no. So keeping those things in mind when you're choosing colors can be really helpful for your learners. Again, remembering accessibility, so avoiding those low contrast color combinations and the red and green combination. And finally, really with any of these principles, you want to implement those major tenets of design we talked about. So contrast, making sure that your colors aren't blending in with one another. Repetition, making sure you're not using too many or too many different colors, things like that. Now this gets into the question of fonts in instructional media. And I've included a picture to as an example off on the side. This sentence goes back and forth between fonts to illustrate just how jarring it can be. And that's something to keep in mind. I think most of us probably don't switch fonts mid-sentence, but it can be tempting to use several different types of fonts throughout a piece of instructional media just because, I mean, it is fun to play with fonts. There are lots of cool ones out there. But in general, it's, again, it follows that sort of less is more idea. We do have a question, should we stick to serif fonts for accessibility reasons? I think that is a very important consideration to stick to those fonts that are easier for individuals who, with various accessibility concerns. I would say that in general, aside from the serif font issue, you also want to avoid overly stylistic fonts that are super curly or super jagged or just difficult to read in general, because even if it's not an accessibility concern, those can be really, really hard to read for your students. Like, save those fonts, you know, if you're designing birthday cards or things like that, where you don't have to worry about whether or not the information is being imparted to your learners. As I mentioned with color, considering the theme of your lesson is important. So again, you might use something that's a little more sleek for a very professional, serious lesson, whereas you might get a little bit more fun with it when you have something that's more lighthearted. Again, limiting the number of fonts is really important so that you don't have too many things and it's not too overwhelming. And remembering to ensure that everything is highly contrasted and aligned and consistent throughout the overall design. Now for the last point, I have considered the Comic Sans controversy, and this has to do with the sort of well-known disdain for Comic Sans that exists in the design community. Is Times New Roman an accessible font? I'm not sure on that one. I believe it is because it's something that is often required in many documents, but that is something that I would need to look into. That one I think is pretty good because it's very readable. It's not, you know, super curly or stylistic. I've heard from a couple of people that it's a little bit hard on the eyes because it's such a sharp font. But other than that, I think that is a pretty safe one to use. Regarding Comic Sans though, there are a lot of memes on the internet talking about how it tends to be viewed as very unprofessional and childish. There are a few articles and studies even written on the fact that people tend to view that as something that you should only really be using in like a K through 12 setting for young children. And I think that given the research on it and given the reputation that that particular font has built up, it is wise to stay away from that when you're designing your instructional media, particularly as teaching assistants for college students. However, if you do go on to become a K-12 teacher or you're doing something that, again, is super lighthearted, that might be a good font for you. So, again, just considering the theme and the needs of your learners is very important when you're making really any design decision. So, Now we're going to go over a few of those design tools I mentioned. The first one is, of course, PowerPoint. And this is not only good for presentations like I'm doing now, but you can use it to create video slides. If you're recording videos with screen capture software, Microsoft PowerPoint is really good for creating those different screens. And you can have a lot of fun with all of the icons and images and animations that PowerPoint has to offer. Additionally, we have VoiceThread. VoiceThread is something that you should have access to as a student at FSU. It's essentially a screen capture software which divides your PowerPoint into separate slides, and then you can create audio recordings on each individual slide. And this is really nice because if you make a mistake on one particular slide, you don't have to redo the entire recording. And it's good for asynchronous lessons because then students are also able to view that particular presentation and they can go slide by slide and leave text or voice comments on slides, which you can then come back to and respond to if you'd like. So it's a really, really good asynchronous tool that allows you to combine visual media with your audio. APowerSoft is a free recording software. There is a paid version, but in my experience, the free version works really well. It allows you to create screen capture videos. You can either record your screen, you can record your webcam like I'm doing now, or you can record a combination of your screen with a small webcam view wherever you choose to drag that feed on your screen. You can also record your audio through the microphone. You can record your computer audio. So if you have sound bites embedded in your PowerPoint, that can be really helpful. Or you can record both. So if you want to be talking and have a few sound effects in your video, you are able to do that through APowerSoft. And it is all totally free, very easy to use. The main issue with it, I would say, is that you have to record everything all in one take unless you have some specific video editing software if you make a mistake. So that's the main thing to keep in mind with that. And lastly, we have free image sources, and these are really important to consider. Personally, I get very paranoid when it comes to copyright and using images in my lessons, so I like to consult sources like Pixabay, FreePic, OpenDoodles to get various images and icons and illustrations to use in my instructional media. Many of these are licensed with a Creative Commons license, which we'll get into later in this presentation. So they're a lot more usable than copyright images. The next tool that I've devoted its own slide to is Canva. This is something else that, again, there are premium versions that you pay for each month, but the free trial version is has a very high level of utility. It is online design software that allows users to create digital and print-based media. So you can make things like social media banners. This is what Pi uses to create a lot of the advertisements we send out via email and through social media. You can also create print-based things like, you know, worksheets or invitations, things like that. Infographics, social media banners, business cards, video clips, all kinds of things. And again, some of these are restricted for the premium version, but you do have access to a lot of these elements for free. You can also include free icons, free photos, free shapes and colors, really all kinds of things are available to you as a template, and you can mix and match things and get really, really creative with it. So we'll do a quick review at this point. We've discussed design principles such as alignment, which again is that idea of making sure that all of your elements are carefully aligned with each other on the screen. Contiguity and proximity, making sure that the various pieces on your instructional media that go together are in close proximity with one another. Repetition, making sure you have consistency in the colors and fonts and other elements throughout your design. Contrast, making sure that the elements of your instructional design on the page stand out from one another. You don't have font blending into the background. Avoiding low contrast and warm, cool color combinations, which can cause eye strain and accessibility concerns. Considering thematically appropriate colors and fonts, depending on the goal of your particular lesson. Bearing in mind issues of readability and accessibility, again, that links back to the issue of contrast. And finally, we've explored a wide range of free design software and image sources that you might choose to utilize while you're creating your instructional media. At this point, we're going to get into the activities. So Fong, if you would please paste the Padlet link into the chat so that everyone can access it more easily. Now, this is called the Bad Design Challenge. And on the right side of the screen, I've listed an example of something that is just a really bad design. It has all kinds of issues with those elements of design that we discussed previously in the PowerPoint. So you have a couple of options for participating here. We're going to be using a tool called Padlet, which is essentially like a map where you paste your ideas, which could be text, you could be share files or images, and they all go on one big screen and create a map of everyone's ideas. So it's really interesting, and you can see what everyone's thinking about and what everyone has to say about this topic. So you have a couple of options for how you can participate. You can critique this design based on the elements we've discussed in the workshop so far. You can give ideas of how it might be improved. You can ask any questions you might have about instructional media design so far. If you'd like, if you're familiar with Canva, I've also included the Canva editing link in this PowerPoint, so you have editing access to it. You could even fix it and post the revised version in the Padlet space. So we're going to take about 15 minutes. We'll come back at, I guess, about 3:45-ish, maybe around there. And we'll talk about what everyone has contributed on the Padlet page. So I will be right here. I'm going to stop my camera feed, but I will be standing by if anyone has any questions. All right, so first off, you all did a fantastic job pointing out some of those major design flaws. And you really did a great job of incorporating the design elements that we have discussed so far throughout this workshop. Many of you pointed out how there's major inconsistency both with the font types and with the colors. You pointed out the issues with contrast in some areas and the very severe lack of alignment among various images on the screen. A few of you also caught that the bullet points are different sizes, which again, that's actually something that can be affected if you use a couple of different fonts throughout your instructional media. So that's something that's really important to check once you have created a piece of instructional media and you're doing your quality assessment afterward. Make sure little details like that, such as bullet points, spacing, alignment, are really important to check when you're revising and editing your instructional media. We also had a few really good questions. One person asked, about Prezi versus PowerPoint. What's the appeal of one over the other? I have not used Prezi very much because in my experience, a lot of classes and work projects I've had that require a presentation of some sort actually requested PowerPoint over Prezi. But I did read an article on it fairly recently, which I pulled up and was going over. And in general, Prezi seems to be liked because you can do a lot with animations and zooming in and out. You can jump all over the place to your different ideas that you have in your presentation, whereas PowerPoint is more linear. You go just in a specific order, you deliver your information very smoothly and efficiently. So overall, Prezi seems to be like because it's really good at engaging an audience with the different animations and the zoom in, zoom out functions it has, whereas PowerPoint is very, very efficient. I think I've seen Prezi used in a few classes to keep students engaged because it's really interesting to see all of the different things that you can do with it regarding animations, as I mentioned before. Oops. Whereas PowerPoint, you know, that's something that you're often going to see with research presentations and more sort of linear things like that, where you need to get the information across to your audience in a very efficient fashion. So there was also a question about Google Slides. I've used Google Slides quite a lot, particularly with group projects. And it's handy because everyone can edit the PowerPoint, everyone has access to it, and Google Slides contains a few templates that are really helpful that you can start out with. It does get a little tricky sometimes when you download the PowerPoint. It might throw all of your fonts and images out of alignment a little bit, in which case, when you download it to your computer, you'll want to go through the PowerPoint and just fix things, push them back to the original position they were. That doesn't always happen, but it is something that can happen when you transition from the online version to the downloaded version. So well, now we'll move on to the next topic of this workshop, which is an introduction to open educational resources. Now, first things first, I'd like to pose a question to all of you. What do you know about open educational resources? You don't have to provide a definition or anything like that, or even if you've never heard of open educational resources, what comes to mind when you hear that terminology? Just give us all an idea of what you think in the chat. I'm going to pause my screen share for a moment just so that I can more easily see the chat function. Yes, so many of you have basically the core idea of OER. They're a lot freer and more accessible. Yeah, that is a really good point. It's a platform where people can share their educational resources. It's really a helpful thing for instructors, particularly who are looking for various types of media to supplement their lesson for the day. Free from intellectual property, yes, sharing of ideas and materials. So yes, you've everyone who has responded in the chat has the main idea of OER, and you'll find a couple of different definitions of it across the internet, but the basic idea is that it is more accessible. It's not always free, but it does tend to be a bit less costly and difficult to utilize compared to traditional copyright sources. So this is a definition that I worked with during my EME 5250 Open Learning and Open Educational Resources course, which is: open educational resources are educational materials that are released at little to no cost with fewer usage restrictions for the general public, depending on the variety of public domain or Creative Commons license and OER uses. Educators typically have greater freedom pertaining to saving, using, and changing that material. So OER specifically refers to materials that are openly licensed and distributed. And what I mean by this is that this is contrasted from the idea of open learning. Now, the open learning idea is a movement that has to do with removing various restrictions to education that could inhibit some groups from being able to easily access it. This means things like open universities, which often have much lower costs associated with them. They often have more open timeframes for students to complete their work, which is really helpful for individuals who need to work full-time while they are pursuing an education. So that is open learning, that is the movement, whereas OER, or open educational resources, is specifically focusing on the educational media itself. Depending on the degree of openness, which is determined by the license type, you can find different types of educational media that are open educational resources in downloadable and editable formats. So that means you can save many of these to your own device, you can change some of them, different things like that. And it includes a wide variety of different media types. You can find books, videos, lessons, plans, worksheets. You can find entire courses online sometimes, which are really helpful if you're doing your own sort of self-guided learning or if you need a particular module or reading lab to share with your students. There are a wide variety of OER options out there for you. So the different Creative Commons licenses that are assigned to the OER you're looking at determine what your responsibilities are as a consumer of OER. You can find in-depth information about each license type at the Creative Commons website, and this is also where you can obtain a Creative Commons license if you create your own open educational resources. But for now, I'm just going to briefly go through the idea of each of the common license types you will see attached to an open educational resource. So the first license type is attribution. This is the license that is most highly accommodating. Individuals who use a resource with this license type are able to change it, edit it, download it, anything they want, really. It can be used for commercial purposes. It can be used for non-commercial purposes. It can be delivered in a public setting, such as a classroom. You can do many different things with this particular license type. The main thing you have to do is credit the original creator of that resource. The second one is attribution share alike. This is mostly the same. However, you have to, if you create an edited version of that particular resource, you have to license that version the same way the original one was licensed. So this essentially makes it so that you can't put a license on a particular OER that, for example, prohibits people from using it for commercial purposes when the original resource didn't have that restriction. The next one is the attribution no derives. Again, this is similar to the other two. It requires you to credit an author. It requires you to make sure that you list the creators and sources where you got that original material. You can use it for commercial purposes, and it is fairly accommodating, as the slide mentions. However, you are not able to share basically edited versions you've created of that resource. So if you download it and you change it in any way, you cannot share it with the public. The next one is attribution non-commercial. This is similar to the attribution license type, except you cannot use it for commercial purposes. Attribution non-commercial share alike. This one is just like the first one, you can't use it with not for commercial purposes, but you also have to use the same license that the original resource used. So you can't remove or add any other restrictions to your adapted version of that resource. And finally, you have the attribution non-commercial no derives license. And this one is probably the least accommodating out of all of the Creative Commons licenses, which that's not to say it's not accommodating, but it does have the most restrictions, which are that you must credit the original author. You cannot share any adapted versions of that author's resource, and you cannot use it for any commercial settings. So again, there's more information on all of these license types on the Creative Commons websites, because they can get a little bit confusing with all of the nuances of what you are and are not allowed to do. But they are very helpful, especially compared to traditional copyright materials, which again can get you in a lot of trouble if you use them improperly without paying for them or without proper citation. So once we determine the license type that a particular OER is using, we can determine our 5R uses. The 5Rs are the actions that you can take pertaining to a particular open educational resources. So the first one is retain, and this is your right to hold a copy of the resource. So that means you can download it to your computer, you can save it on a flash drive, you can hold that resource and, you know, hold on to it. The second one is revise, And again, as the name suggests, that this means that you can adapt it, you can change, edit it, translate it into another language. Whatever you'd like to do, if the license allows, you can revise that particular open educational resource. Remix, this is my personal favorite. This means that the license allows you to create a mashup of educational media. So let's say you download an open educational resource that is a reading lab. You can take that reading lab, you can combine it with videos, you can combine it with worksheets or your own learning objectives. You basically create an all new mashup of content that could be really helpful and customizable for your students. Reuse means that you're able to use the information on a public platform. As I mentioned before, this is usually a classroom for open educational resources. Some of the license types, as I mentioned, don't allow you to do this with any changed versions you've created of an OER, but some of them do, and this means you are able to share them with your students. And finally, redistribute is the final R. This means that you're able to distribute the open educational resource to others. So this could be sharing the link with other individuals. It could be printing copies of a worksheet and giving it out to people. Again, it just depends on the Creative Commons license type that is assigned to that specific open educational resource. And the cool thing with these licenses is that you can usually click on them or just Google them if they're not clickable on the open educational resource you found, and they'll take you to the Creative Commons site and it will list for you exactly what you're allowed to do with that resource and what your obligations are as a user in terms of crediting the original author. So at this point, you might be wondering, how do we find OER for individual classrooms or personal use? There are many different options for doing this. OER repositories is a huge one that I've often used to find open educational resources to help with creating different types of media. OER Commons is my personal favorite repository because it's essentially a database where you can go in and you search for open educational resources, which you can filter by content type, like what the topic is. You can filter it by age group, and it goes anywhere from K through 12 to graduate and professional level students. You can even put a few filters to make sure that the resources that are being shared follow specific quality measurement standards, such as Common Core, Quality Matters, things like that. So OER repositories are a good source if you want a wide variety of different types of materials that are openly licensed. There are also resources online that include specific media types. So if you're interested specifically in books or maybe in entire courses or course modules, there are a lot of different online resources where you can find only those types of media. And with any of these, it's always important to implement your own quality assessment skills. I think there's often an idea that if something is free, it may not be of the best quality. And while this is certainly true in some cases, it is not always the case. But if you want to make sure that you are getting something that is a good quality open resource, simply go through the resource before you're ready to use it. You can check things like spelling and grammar, see what the quality is like there. You can go back to those design tenets we talked about earlier with contrast and alignment and repetition and proximity and contiguity. And you can make sure that everything is working visually on the open educational resource you're using. And of course, as a TA in your specific field, you can go through and make sure that the information seems accurate and up to date. And that's just important, an important skill to practice as you are researching and utilizing open educational resources. And thank you so much. Someone shared an FSU library resource for a guide to OER. So that can be really helpful if you are learning how to use this particular educational resource. So, a few notes on attribution. As I've mentioned several times before, the license type is key. That will let you know exactly what you need to do in terms of usage and crediting the original creator. There's also a method you can use, which is TASL. And this is where, as you are crediting the original author and the original source for that piece of media, you want to, in general, list the title, author, source, so mainly the source location, such as a link to a database or another website, and the license type. Those are the major pieces of information that you'll need to list when you are crediting the original resource. When you're looking for where to place that citation, a general rule of thumb is to place it where it feels natural on the media you're creating or sharing. This could be maybe in the corner of a page, somewhere where it's not obstructing any of the other pieces of your visual design. I have linked a resource down below, which will give you even more information about specific cases, such as if you're doing a video, how and where do you include attribution for any OER you use. This will go through specific scenarios of how you can properly do this. So at this point, we get to a project I helped work on during the spring 2020 semester. This was for EME 5250, which is the graduate level open learning and open educational resources course. The entire course was centered on one major project, which was meant to be the outcome once the course concluded. So the class started out researching and brainstorming OER categories for our target audience. And in this case, our target audience included other instructional designers and educators. So we thought about what topics pertaining to OER would be helpful for educating people in our field or people in other educational fields on the nature of OER. Once we conducted this brainstorming session, we devised the list of those specific topics and the medium types we would be creating. And in general, we focused on things like teaching teachers how to find OER, how to properly use OER based on the license type. We gave them ideas and templates for creating a lesson plan that is based entirely on OER, things that they could take both for their own education and for adaptation directly to their courses. We developed and evaluated a variety of OER. My specific group worked on creating lesson plan templates and guides that taught teachers just the basics of how to find, create, utilize, and attribute original creators pertaining to OER. And finally, we developed an OER repository, which was a Google site where we placed all of these resources, and they are fully available online to anyone who has the link. And this is our logo that we developed for the overall project. I've listed the project link over on the side. So if you're interested in learning more how to create and utilize open educational resources for your classroom, you are welcome to follow that link and it will take you to the repository, and you'll be able to go through any topics that you'd like more information on. And there's also more information about the complete authorship of this project, which includes every single student in that section of EME 5250. So all authorship attribution is included on the website. So at this point, we can recap a little bit about what we've talked about during this section. So open educational resources, again, in general, are materials that tend to bear fewer usage restrictions and are a little bit easier for educators to take and adapt to their classroom. These usage rights and obligations for providing attribution tend to depend on the license type that's assigned to a resource. So if you have an attribution license, that's very, very free and open. Whereas if you have something with a non-commercial restriction, that applies a few more responsibilities and limitations to what you can do. The internet has all kinds of different OER databases and websites. As I mentioned before, you can find entire databases with many different medium types, or you can find more limited websites which contain specifically books or specifically courses or modules. And as I mentioned, please feel free to access and utilize the resource that was created by the EME 5250 group. We actually have a little bit of extra time, so I think I will go ahead and show everyone what that resource looks like. So let me share my browser screen. Okay. So this is the database. You can see that we have split the resource into various different topics. We have a basic introduction. We have far more in-depth information about copyright and Creative Commons licenses that, again, if you're at all nervous or uncertain about what your responsibilities are as a user or creator of open educational resources, you can find all kinds of information about what those various licenses can do for you. There's tips about locating and sharing OER. So if you're having trouble finding exactly what you want, you'll find some information about that in that section. Adapting OER for classroom use, that contains a lot of the guides and the templates. If you are interested in creating an OER-based lesson, that will help you to accomplish that. We have designing for the 5 R's. This sort of links back into our media design topic earlier in the workshop. This will kind of show you how you can design worksheets or infographics, booklets, whatever the case may be, while keeping those 5 R tenets in mind to make sure that if you do want to share that resource you've created, you can do so in a way that allows others to share it and adapt it as they wish. There's a section on accessibility, which I think is a huge concern, particularly now that we're going pretty much entirely online. That's something that we all need to consider in terms of making sure that everything is visually accessible and any audio in our videos is completely accessible. And there's also more information, as I mentioned before, about providing attribution when using OER, because this can get a little bit tricky. There's a lot of information associated with open educational resources. So this will tell you general rules of thumb for what you need to cite and where you should place those citations. So at this point, we have about 20 minutes left. And I think I will open it up for any questions that you might have. I'm going to stop my feed for a moment, but I will be right here if anyone wants to talk through the microphone or text a question in the chat. Feel free to do so. So this is what the home screen of Canva looks like. You can see there are all different types of templates that come up automatically. You don't have to use any of these if you don't want to. You can start with a completely blank design. So I think that's what I'll do for the purposes of this example. We'll click social media. This tends to be just a small size that is pretty easy to work with. And you see it's given me a blank canvas that I can utilize to start adding elements to the screen. So I think what we'll do with this is we'll create a general guide for COVID safety tips. So let's type in frame. Oops, that's in the wrong thing. Okay. So to search for all the different things you can do with Canva, you can click on elements and it will give you all types of options. You can find illustrations, you can find grids, and grids are really helpful if you want to divide your pictures in a very specific manner. You can create a grid of four, you can create a grid of two, which when you place a picture into a grid, it will automatically format to fit that grid, so you don't have to struggle with changing sizes and making sure that each piece of the grid is 100% identical to the other pieces. There are also shapes, so you can insert circle, triangle, squares, more advanced shapes, things like that. You can insert stickers. Some of these are animated and some are not. So if you'd like to create social media banners that serve as little short video clips, you can do that. And you can have your elements moving and dancing across the screen, which is really good for getting people's attention. There are chart options, gradient options, lines, symbols, all kinds of things that you can use to really sort of bring life into your design. So I think what I'll do here is I'll type in frame. And this gives us a few options for just making the border of our design a little bit more colorful. And I think I'll choose this one because it's fairly simple. And you see it just automatically formats it to my screen here. And I can make it bigger, smaller, I can move it all over the page. And the cool thing about Canva, well, one cool thing about Canva is that it gives you these lines. So you see, if I move it around, the lines are changing or disappearing and reappearing. And this helps me achieve alignment. So I know when my frame or my image or my text or whatever other elements I'm working with is aligned with other pieces on the template. So now we have the frame in place. I think I'll go over to text. For text, you can do different templates, as you see below this. These tend to be good for if you're trying to advertise an event for your organization, things like that. You can use any of these templates, but I'm just going to use the subheading option to create a fairly large text block. You can change the font. In this case, I'm going to, I think we'll change it to this one. And when you look through these fonts, the ones that have the crowns next to them mean that those are part of the premium Canva package. So they are easily marked and you're able to tell which elements you have access to as a free user and which ones you don't and which ones you will need to pay for. So you won't ever accidentally click on something that tries to charge your account. So if we're doing COVID safety tips, let's put we'll do three tips. We'll do wash hands frequently, maintain social distance, and follow CDC. So now that we have our text that we want to put here, you can drag it all over the screen, and again, those lines will help you so much with determining where you need to put an element to make sure that it's aligned with the other pieces in your instructional media. So this one, we'll put it right in the middle here just for sake of the demonstration. And now let's say we want a title. This inserts another box, which you can move around. You can also do things like make it tilt from side to side, but you probably won't use those functions as often because, again, it can cause a few issues with it being difficult to read if it's too slanted. So we'll put a title here. Oops. And then we'll bold it to make sure that everything is highly contrasted with the rest of the media. And some of the fonts will allow you to bold while others will not. And it will, again, the program will automatically tell you what you can and can't do with different design elements, which I think is really helpful. So we're gonna put this up here. It's right in the middle according to our grid. And then we'll go back to elements. And let's say we want some sort of image in the background of our media to make it pop a little bit more. I'll type in health to go with the theme. We'll click on this one because it's free. And again, you can see this pops up with a little free icon, which I really enjoy as a designer, because personally, I'm always afraid I'm going to click on something that is going to end up charging me. So we'll put this here. And this is a tool that I really enjoy, and that is the transparency function, where you can make various images, symbols, text, other things transparent to exist in the background of your design. So this one, I've set the transparency to be very, very high. And we have this in the background of the design. And again, this is nothing high quality, of course, but this is just to show you just a couple of the things that you can do with this tool. It's highly versatile. It's very easy to use. And you can download some of your designs. You can, if you do have a premium account, I think you have a few more options for downloading and distributing your designs. And you can also share editing links with other individuals. So if you have a design you're working on with a group, you can give them the link. All they have to do is create a free Canva account, and they are able to access it and begin editing as well. So now that we have our demonstration out of the way, I think I will devote the rest of the time remaining to any questions or comments you all may have. Angela Donahue, she says, I think it would be great to have a how-to library. With most of these technologies, I have to teach myself by clicking around and or watching hours of YouTube videos searching for the pertinent information. I think this is part of the reason that some instructors don't implement tools that can help and add to accessibility. I agree, and I think accessibility is something that can be especially daunting when we're designing and creating instructional media, because there are so many pieces to it. You have to pay attention to audio, visuals, organization, all types of things. Thankfully, with the rise of the remote learning we're doing right now, I think there is going to be a rise of information, because it's now necessary to make sure that things are as accessible as they can be, which actually leads me into talking about PI's Canvas site. It's the PI TA Community Support Forum. If you're not already enrolled in that course, you can do so as a FSU student and TA. And it's essentially a resource that gives you access to all different types of materials and information for making the change from face-to-face learning to online learning. And there's an actual community to it. So if you have questions, if you want to visit office hours and talk to someone about some of the challenges you're facing making that transition from face-to-face to online learning, that is available to you if you enroll in this site. And there is definitely some information about accessibility guidelines and design guidelines, things like that. We also have a workshop coming up on the 22nd, as Dr. Liceno mentioned, and that's going to go into a few topics of assessment. So I definitely encourage all of you to attend that. It's gonna be really great. I know that's a topic that can get really, really challenging when we're dealing with online learning and how do we ensure academic integrity when it comes to online learning. So again, just lots of valuable resources you can access through PI and through the Office of Distance Learning. But if there are no other questions, I think I'll go ahead and hand it over to Dr. Liceno and Fong. Thank you so much to all of you for coming. It was really great getting to talk to all of you and hear your ideas and your feedback.
Thank you, Katie. I was just trying to put the, let's see if I got it here, the link so you can self-enroll in the Canvas site you were talking about. Is it in there? I don't know what's going on. Yeah. Oh, Fawn put it in. Thank you, Fawn. So the Canvas site that Katie was talking about, and Katie helped build that. when she was my grad assistant for PI. It does have a lot of resources, quite a few of which Katie put together on how to move your face-to-face class to an online class. And I think that idea of putting together a how-to manual for different types of these resources is a great idea. So thanks for all your feedback. And Fung also put a link to our evaluation in the chat box. So a few comments up, you'll see that, but we'll also email it to you. And we'll also have the recording of Katie's workshop on the PI website by tomorrow, if not later tonight, probably tomorrow. So you'll have that as well too. You can go back and look at Katie's workshop. So thank you all for coming. If you do have any questions, I'm sure Katie can stick around for a couple minutes. Otherwise, we hope that we see you. My camera got pushed off. We hope we see you at our next workshop on the 22nd, and I'll be in touch and we'll let you know about the online course design bootcamp that I was telling you about, where you'll have a lot of time to work on putting together your online course for the fall. So thank you for coming. Thank you, Katie, for an awesome job and sharing your expertise with us. And have a great week, everyone.